John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And we heard a lot of big ideas from the president in his State of the Union address. But perhaps the biggest last night, the one most Americans would be happy with, even if nobody goes back to the moon or heads off to Mars in the next 2 years, finding a way for this Democratic president to work productively with this Republican Congress.
If you share the broad vision I outlined tonight, I ask you to join me in the work at hand. If you disagree with parts of it, I hope you'll at least work with me where you do agree. And I commit to every Republican here tonight that I will not only seek out your ideas, I will seek to work with you to make this country stronger.
What big ideas do you endorse from the president to make this country stronger? What's practical to achieve in 2015? What would you like the government to tackle? We'd love to hear from you, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or go to thetakeaway.org. We'll be sharing some of your suggestions all hour long. In an hour-long address last night, the president underscored a Reagan-like rosy picture of national values, of global influence, and good times for the estimated 30 million Americans who tuned in.
At this moment, with a growing economy, shrinking deficits, bustling industry, booming energy production, we have risen from recession freer to write our own future than any other nation on earth. It's now up to us to choose who we want to be over the next 15 years and for decades to come. Will we accept an economy where only a few of us do spectacularly well? Or will we commit ourselves to an economy that generates rising incomes and chances for everyone who makes the effort?
We will have an assessment of this positive and hopeful national agenda. The arresting symbols last night of who stood when, who smiled and clapped, and who sat stone-faced while the president spoke. We'll talk about that. It wasn't always a strictly party line picture. We'll also look at stories outside Washington, D.C., an unusual humanitarian approach to the civil war in Syria, and the ISIS hostage tragedy unfolding right now in Japan. But we begin with Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
So it was a pretty hopeful-seeming tone last night. The president seemed very, very comfortable from the podium. What did you observe in the chamber there?
Well, you observed a president who's not running again, which he pointed out to the country and to Republicans. He doesn't have any elections left to run. That's obvious. But also it seemed to free him up a bit, a president who was much more comfortable delivering the speech and seemed a lot more comfortable dealing with a Congress that's largely recalcitrant. But, John, you know, there are lots of policies. There was a bit of a laundry list in the speech, a little bit less so than in previous years, perhaps. But I think the subtext underneath the speech was maybe a lot more important. You know, the president has labored his whole presidency under a deep economic recession, banking and housing collapses and wars. And really, it's, you know, it's eaten up a lot of the capital and the energy of his presidency, I think. And now it seems like he wants some credit. The economy has turned around. Unemployment is down. Manufacturing is up. And the president wants to have some legacy benefit to the turnaround. And I think that was a lot of the positioning of this speech and a lot of the challenging to Republicans in Congress. Look, there's also a battle cry in there. You played the part of the speech where the president wanted some conciliation. Look, there are areas where we can get along. Let's not dive into cable news and gaffes and one-upping each other. Let's be productive. But he was also defiant. He did lay out the laundry list of the things he wants that he knows Republicans either can't or won't entertain on immigration, on economic issues, a big tax increase for the very wealthy to fund some middle class initiatives, including free community college and tax credits for people. He knows he's not going to get these things. And John, I think there was sort of a warning underneath all of this. And I heard the president saying to Republicans, maybe, but to the country, definitely, look, this next election is not going to be like 2012. It's going to be kind of sunny in America economically. You people are all going to feel a lot differently about me and my legacy in 2016 because things will be going pretty well. And Republicans, income inequality is a major issue. You've acknowledged it. Everybody in the country knows it. And if you want to have an election and fight on the value of middle class advancement after sort of a great 2 years of the last bits of the Obama presidency. That's a fight that Democrats would like to have. So help me get to work now or fight on our turf in 2016.
If we're to separate this into three big themes, and you've outlined the three of them there, the goodie bag of proposals, and it'd be great if you could tick off some of those for just a moment to remind us, the plea for let's work together, which we also alluded to, and this sense that, hey, good times are back, which would you say is the most important?
Certainly not the goodie bag. Maybe the goodie bag is important for 2016 because it gives the next Democratic nominee a place to push off of. Republicans are not going to pass a lot of those things in the goodie bag. We mentioned tax increases on the very wealthy, a tax on big a tax, although if you're a Republican, you might see it as an attack on the biggest banks making over $50 billion. Free community college, tax credits for second earners, expanded child tax credits, and all the rest. That was a big goodie bag that the president mentioned. I think that the most important part of this speech in the subtext was the president taking credit for an economy that is perceived to have turned around by many, many voters. And the polls showed that going into the speech. But also really an acknowledgement for the country in explicit terms that the economic turnaround has left behind middle class wages. This is not a last 5 years problem, John. This is a generational problem. And none of the things in the president's goodie bag list or laundry list or whatever we're calling it are going to turn that around. But what I heard was a prelude to 2016, where if the middle class feels left behind while the big banks are still doing great, and combined with the fact that Democrats are viewed a lot more favorably in voters' eyes than they would have been even in this last midterm election when Obama did get trounced by Republicans, that is going to spell a very populist, very favorable set of conditions for Democrats if Republicans don't move and come around and agree with him on a few of those on a few issues.
Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent in the gallery last night as the president delivered his State of the Union address.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
In Iraq and Syria, American leadership, including our military power, is stopping ISIL's advance. Instead of getting dragged into another ground war in the Middle East, we are leading a broad coalition, including Arab nations, to degrade and ultimately destroy this terrorist group.
A coalition including Asian nations. This week, Japan is the target of the latest hostage event from ISIS. And while the president last night touted the value of these strong international coalitions in fighting terrorism, the government of Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe may be having second thoughts about the promise of $200 million in non-military aid to the nations fighting ISIS. That's the amount ISIS says it wants to get from Japan to prevent the video execution of two Japanese hostages. Martin Fackler, Tokyo bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times, is now with us from Tokyo. Martin, welcome.
Hello, John.
How much is this hostage crisis and Japan's participation in the fight against ISIS a domestic issue in Japan right now?
The interest is intense. I mean, this is the lead news item here. And, you know, for Japan, this is not the first time they've faced this sort of thing, but it's not something they face anywhere near as often as the U.S. And in many ways, it feels like a new challenge to them. And so I think there's a lot of soul searching and questioning going on about how deeply does Japan want to get involved in the Middle East, and is supporting its ally, the United States, worth the lives of its citizens? Is it worth getting embroiled in these sorts of situations where Japanese can die?
The $200 million number, of course, echoes the amount of aid that Japan has promised to the ISIS-fighting coalition. But I'm wondering if it's also an indication that maybe ISIS is winking to the world and saying, hey, Japan has paid ransom in the past, and so they're a place to go to get cash here. Or is that completely, speculation?
Well, Japan did pay in the past. There was a case in 1999 with an official at one of the public companies that looks for natural resources, I think in this case metals, who was abducted in Kyrgyzstan and was eventually released And while the government's never admitted it, essentially it's an open secret that many millions of dollars were paid. But if you look more recently, I think Japan has tried to change its behavior and its reputation. You know, it's been criticized a long time as essentially a pocketbook for either American policy or perhaps in this case, a pocketbook willing to pay off kidnappers. And I think Japan is serious about trying to change that image. Prime Minister Abe is trying to bring Japan closer in line with the practices of the United States and its close allies like the UK and Australia. And I think not giving in to terrorists, not paying demands like this will be part of that. The question is, you know, whether he can convince the public and other members of his party to go along with that or not. One more element of this is the size of the demand, essentially $100 million per hostage. That doesn't feel like a number that even ISIS would realistically expect to be getting. It feels to me like essentially it's a political statement, and perhaps these two unfortunate men really don't have much hope.
And you alluded to this at the beginning of the conversation, but remind us just how torn Japan has traditionally been with wanting to be a player on the world stage, particularly in Asia, as China's clout has risen over the last 20 years, and wanting to stay out of these matters at the same time.
Well, I think you have to go back to 1945 and just the shock of not only the utter defeat that Japan suffered, but the feeling that it had been betrayed by its leaders and it had gone into this dark militarism that really wasn't something that the nation should have done, to put it simply. And there's a lot of remorse and I think regret about that. And so the way Japan's reacted to that is to have this strong aversion to anything that smacks of military action overseas, getting involved in conflicts. I mean, it's just even today, a deep-seated allergy to anything like that. And so that's one part of what's going on. And as you mentioned, the rise of China, on the other hand, is changing the equation in Asia. It really is changing the dynamic. And into that comes the current prime minister, Shinzo Abe, who has this vision of making Japan into a normal country in the sense of a full-fledged ally of the United States along the lines of the UK or Australia, or perhaps not quite that far in terms of military participation in U.S. ventures, but in other ways, joining the U.S. as really a global ally. As he pushes Japan to try to do more and more, even if it's non-military aid, right, non-lethal aid, he's got this constant pushback of people who are like, no, we don't want to get involved. You know, Japan has had 70 prosperous years after World War II, and we just don't want to change the formula. So that's kind of the tension. Those are the various conflicting poles that you're seeing now.
And at the center of it are the two hostages. I mean, what do we know about them, and how closely are people in Japan following the personal narrative of these individuals?
We know a bit about both of them, mainly through Japanese media sources at this point. But one of them, a fellow named Yukawa Haruna, is a man who I guess you could describe went to Syria to kind of find himself. He's sort of a lost soul, so to speak. His wife died of lung cancer. His business went bankrupt. He was briefly homeless. And then he shows up in Syria as sort of a self-proclaimed, you know, military advisor of some sort. You know, he doesn't advise anybody, but he just is sort of a, you know, he shows up in combat fatigues and videos that he posts on his website, shooting an AK-47 at a practice range somewhere. And he befriended some members of the Free Syria Army, apparently, and was with them when their position was overrun by ISIS and was captured, apparently in August of last year. The other gentleman is a fellow named Goto Kenji, who is a journalist, a freelance journalist. What seems to be the case there is that he had met the other fellow, Yukawa-san, in Syria and somehow felt responsibility for the capture of Mr. Yukawa and had gone into Syria to try to secure his release sometime in October. And that's when Mr. Goto was apparently abducted.
Martin Fackler is Tokyo Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much, Martin.
No, it was my pleasure, John. Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
The president spoke of the persistent tragedy in Syria once again, and now he wants to reach out to people he has said in the past can be partners for achieving an elusive peace.
We're also supporting a moderate opposition in Syria that can help us in this effort, and assisting people everywhere who stand up to the bankrupt ideology of violent extremism. Now, this effort will take time. It will require focus, but we will succeed.
But Syrians both inside the country and around the world are not waiting for the U.S. cavalry. Today we return to a Syrian exile journalist, Hani El-Sayed, and meet her collaborator, filmmaker Charlotte Eager, who have produced a radio soap opera to reach out to Syrian civilians in the middle of the conflict. The popular series, We Are All Refugees, is not about fighting. It's about understanding.
لك يا أهلا وسهلا إن شاء الله عجبك الأكل سيد رامي عجبك الأكل
والله يخلف يخلف يا أخوي يا فادي أي شو هذا يا زلمة أي كثير زاكي بصراحة
صح وهنا
والله أسكم من
That's an excerpt from this unusual series that began with an inspiration from filmmaker Charlotte Eager.
The idea of it came from a trip that I made to Zaatari a year ago in Jordan, where I went with Oxfam, and we were looking at putting on a production of Euripides' great anti-war tragedy, The Trojan Women, which is about refugees. And we were looking at doing it with Syrian refugees, which we did last year. And we did this with Oxfam. So when I was in the camp, Oxfam introduced me to a lot of women to talk to as we were looking for a cast. And the women said to me, you know, it's awful. What's going on here? You know, I'm marrying my daughter off. I'm marrying her to a Jordanian. She's only 16. She doesn't want to be married. But frankly, it's terrible for single girls in this camp. You know, people gossip about them. They call them flirts or sluts. There's a risk when the girls go to the bathroom at night. There's no police here. There's a risk that they might be sexually molested or that people will think they're sexually molested. And essentially, all these girls, like these young unmarried girls, had left their only asset was their reputation and their virginity.
We Are Refugees has so far broadcast a 6-part pilot. The project is backed by the United Nations High Commission on Refugees, written by a joint team of both Syrians and Jordanians, telling stories of refugees who've had to completely upend their lives.
The lead character on our soap opera is a young guy called Firaz. He's a young Syrian guy. His mother and his sister are in the refugee camp with his elder brother. Elder brother wants to marry the sister off to keep her safe and so he can marry a sexy young widow called Nora. Meanwhile, Firaz is working as a valet parker in Amman. He's on about $150 a month. He's really depressed. He's so depressed he doesn't turn up to work a lot of the times. But he was once an incredibly talented musician. Now, his family, which is an aspirant middle-class family, Syria had a huge aspirant middle class. It was a very middle class country. They wanted him to be an engineer. So he gave up music, studied engineering at university, didn't finish his degree because of the war, had to flee because he was being called up to fight in the army, ends up in Amman. And suddenly his music becomes the door through which he can go and have a new and interesting life. So for the first, it's 6 episodes long, for the first 4 episodes, he's thoroughly depressed and miserable and even denies that he used to play the oud, which is the great instrument he was fantastic at. And then he discovers that actually, in Amman, playing an Arabic instrument is better paid than being a valet parker. Hmm. And so what was an irresponsible choice in the settled middle-class world, bourgeois world he was brought up in, becomes a better choice than the reality of just being a valet parker.
I can imagine so many stories like that about refugees who had to change their lives. Hani El-Sayed, were you surprised as a journalist by the power of this kind of storytelling in the episodes that were produced, that you co-produced?
No, not at all. This is something I've been advocating for a very long time in my lifetime, and since I was able to, you know, own a microphone in the sense of, again, that platform. And I truly believe in the interplay of the arts and the media when they come together. It's amazing what it can do. What it can do for peace-building practitioners, what it can do for transition in conflict, what it can do to reform a whole conflict into something that the way you would like it to end. And the whole point of this is that you are working with the population. You are working with the people that are being affected, not the fighters, not the governments, not the proxy, not the media wars even. And when you have these narratives told, people who speak the language This is a healing process for them. This is allowing them to have the dialogue. This is opening up their eyes. It's like an educational tool, but through a narrative. You're not giving them a lesson about peace. You're not giving them a lesson about their life. This is life. And it's very important. And actually having these, and Charlotte and I have spoken about this, to put this, to have this in English is very important, because the narrative, there's no lack of information about news of what's happening in Syria. It is the narrative that's being told that's the issue. It is the, this is them and this is us. It's these people there. The limited narrative, it's limiting the people as a whole.
And an English version of your soap opera hopefully will change that. Before we go to both of you, do you get fan mail?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, we get emails from people who really like it. And there's been a 92% loyalty on the episode so far. It's very exciting. And getting it recorded in English is our next goal. It's the project we're working on at the moment. We want to broadcast it in the US, in the UK, and all over the English-speaking world, so that this story can get out there, so the narratives of these people can be heard all over the world. Because the Syrian refugee crisis is something that we can't forget. And Honey's mentioned ISIS now, but it really is quite apart from the fact that we must help, we have a moral obligation to help people. It's in our self-interest, because these refugees camps are the recruiting grounds of ISIS. We know this from anecdotal evidence. I think Honey herself came across a case when she was last in a refugee camp in Syria a few months ago, you know, when a young guy that she'd met before, he'd gone off to join ISIS. And of course, it's understandable if you're in a refugee camp and you've got no hope and no money and life's awful. You may well go to the guys who are giving you a cause and money and a gun. And what we really hope is that by getting this story out there, the world will really sit up and look and see that something has to be done.
Honey, take us out. Like, final thoughts?
I can't but agree with what Charlotte is saying. Today we have over half the population displaced. If you don't help Syrians thrive and not just having them survive, we even have a problem with that, then it will be not only a recruiting ground for ICE, but these people one day want to go back. Yeah. What are they going to go back with? So if we don't invest in them today, if we don't help Syrians thrive today, it's going to be an even more of a humanitarian catastrophe than it already is in our modern time. It's the worst. It's a human duty, actually, that we are able to help, and that we as a media, it's a responsibility to start changing that narrative and not see things as black and white. Syria is not a balanced issue. It's not a conflict between two. It's not giving Syrians a choice that they can choose between Democrats and Republicans. It's not that at all. It's about the people, and we need to start telling their stories.
Hani El-Sayed is host, producer, and co-founder of Radio Suriali. And Charlotte Eager is filmmaker and journalist and co-producer of the soap opera We Are All Refugees. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you very much, John, for having us.
Well, thank you.
The State of the Union.
The State of our Union.
State of the Union.
Is going to be fine.
Very, very public.
A complete disaster.
A little more honest.
Business as usual.
So at the end of this hour, let's consider what kind of a moment this is for large-scale presidential ambitions. The president's big ideas last night ranged from getting the parties to work together more productively to making 2 years of community college free for all Americans. Lots of other proposals in there. Joining us is Sean Wilentz, a professor of history at Princeton University. He's the author of The Age of Reagan, A History and the Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln. Sean, welcome.
Great to be here.
So, What are your assessments? He laid out an agenda, but it wasn't necessarily go to the moon. It certainly felt ambitious to have the parties work together. This seems like a curious, unique moment.
Well, he's laying out an agenda that may not come to pass, but that's not the point. I mean, I thought it was a very effective, very strong speech by the president last night. Maybe the best he's given, certainly as a State of the Union address. Fitting the moment, historically fitting the moment, which is, look, he's come off of a bad midterm. Now he's good looking to the last 2 years of his administration, and he's laying out a very strong, very popular middle-class agenda. I mean, that's what he did last night. He not only laid it out, but he explained why it's necessary. He justified it. He explained it better than he has before, I think. So I thought in laying all of that out, it was very strong. The point is not to think that these are things are going to pass right now. They're not going to pass, most likely, with this Congress. But it does then put the Congress on notice. If it doesn't pass, it's then the Republicans' responsibility. These are very popular things. If this doesn't happen, it's because the Republicans didn't do it. And that's very clear. He's laying out an agenda, not only a political agenda, but laying down markers for another Democratic president to come along and pick up.
I thought he played this tonal game of impressions that Reagan did so well. It felt like an echo of the good times morning in America sometimes. Here is one example of that.
With a growing economy, shrinking deficits, bustling industry, booming energy production, we have risen from recession freer to write our own future than any other nation on earth.
Now, is he right there? Because he is, as you said, come off a dreadful midterm. This is a good recovery, but it's nothing like the Clinton recovery. Is he right to evoke this, or is he playing a rhetorical game?
No, I think he's right to evoke it because it's coming off of not what Clinton was coming off of, but off of the worst financial disaster in American history since the Great Depression. So we've come a long way. We're not where we were in the 90s, but we're very far from where we were 6 years ago. And I think he has to point that out because not everybody's always been feeling that. And in some ways, he was laying out why you're not all feeling it, because there are all of these inequalities built into the recovery itself, as strong as it has been. So I didn't hear so much Reagan there, although there is the always implicit the greatness of America. But I heard him trying to say, look, we really are going now. You know, the engines have started, the engines are motoring up, things are going. Now we have to get somewhere else. We have to push on with this. But we're, the very beginning was we've turned a new page. We're not where we were a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. We've come out of all of that. I think that's right. If the economy keeps on going strong, then the Republicans will be in another difficulty because they'll have to explain not only why their economy is strong despite them, they'll try to claim credit for it, but why they're not doing these things.
So does Obama dare at this moment to embark on a Johnsonian objective? Can any president do that? Can you do what Ronald Reagan did in international diplomacy? Can any president do that now?
Well, I think that he can try. I mean, he won't succeed with this Congress. I mean, Lyndon Johnson could be Lyndon Johnson for the 2 years that he was the great Lyndon Johnson because he had a Democratic Congress. Barack Obama does not have that. But it's a different kind of leadership, or it's rather leadership under a different set of circumstances, under adversity, which may be, in fact, the way President Obama operates best is under adversity.
And we heard the confidence under adversity. Let's listen to some of the LBJ confidence with a huge wind behind him.
This Civil Rights Act is a challenge to all of us to go to work in our communities and our states, in our homes and in our hearts, to eliminate the last vestiges of injustice in our beloved country.
And he achieved it. And then here's President Obama last night evoking the Johnsonian agenda in the Voting Rights Act in one of the most stirring moments. But again, he's proposing nothing new here.
We may go at it in campaign season, but surely we can agree that the right to vote is sacred, that it's being denied to too many. And that on this 50th anniversary of the Great March from Selma to Montgomery and the passage of the Voting Rights Act, we can come together, Democrats and Republicans, to make voting easier for every single American.
Well, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, look, voting rights is under attack state by state by state. This is nothing that and the Voting Rights Act's been gutted by the Supreme Court. So he's laying down a very strong marker there. I thought it was a very effective part of the speech, picking up the Johnsonian legacy from 50 years ago, but saying, look, it's under attack, and we have to protect it and expand upon it.
Although is the footnote there, you know, instead of going to the moon, the president is essentially saying, let's get back to the status quo. That's a different form of ambition.
Well, I think that the status quo always has to be, if it's a status quo that was based on what it was 50 years ago, those kinds of reforms, you always have to protect it. It's always going to be under attack, which is really what the Republican Party's been about in this instance of breaking down rights that have been guaranteed. He's also going to the moon because he talked about Mars a little bit. I'll just throw that
in.
But, you know, there was a wrinkle to the speech, and that came at the very end. I mean, Barack Obama came to the presidency, certainly got the nomination, talking about post-partisanship, we all have to get together, there's one America, all of that. That was the end of the speech. That was what he got to the presidency on. That wasn't so effective. You know, that didn't get him very far. I think he still wants to justify that. I think he still clings to that idea. It's a very wonderful, noble idea. He may have gotten the nomination in the election originally on that basis. But it's not very good politically. It's no way to govern. The first part of the speech, the first three quarters of the speech, was him having learned to govern and to lead as a president. So it was a funny tension between the two because he still wants to justify those ideas. But I think he's learned, and I think it showed last night, how to be that kind of powerful president that we think of when we think of Johnson or Reagan or any of the others.
I don't want to talk about trade policy here, but before we go, it seemed to me that the most ambitious moment of the speech was when he said, we should write the trade rules.
Yeah.
Everyone says China's rising. We should write the trade rules because we're economically stronger than China right now. What'd you think of that?
Well, I think he's laying down again. On trade, the Democrats have been divided going back to the Clinton period. He's trying to unite the country, really, around the idea that we are powerful in this world and we're going to exert our power.
More powerful than we think, even.
Well, perhaps. But the point is, in terms of trade, we're not messing around here. I mean, the Chinese are really up to doing what they're doing, and we're going to confront them. We're going to make it happen. The other part of the wrinkle, though, was I thought one of the most interesting parts of the speech was when he told them to screw off, in effect. When in a self-referential moment, he talked about how he's not going to be elected again, his last campaign. But the Republicans can't help themselves. They start applauding, right? It was rude. This is the State of the Union. You don't do that. And there was a powerful moment when he just looked at them and said, yeah, but I won the last two. It was kind of in your face. It was a moment where I saw him on trade as well, but in all these other ways, being himself and being strong.
Sean Wilentz is a professor of history at Princeton University. He's the author of The Age of Reagan, A History and the Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, talking about this age, last 2 years, of Barack Obama. Sean, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
We want to know your views on the State of the Union speech, your idea of big ideas and whether they're possible in America in the first 15 years or the rest of this century. If you want to catch up on that conversation or anything else on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org and Lumosity.com. Introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.